The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
And Ralph Bunche is the guy who puts it together. So he becomes the key kind of organizer and implementer. So he gathers the troops, he meets with the different countries. It's amazing because he gets so many offers. So he later says, you know, I couldn't use half of the troops that were offered to me for this peacekeeping mission, which if you know anything about peacekeeping today, you know that the Secretary General has to kind of go around hat in hand trying to get troops, and it's often very difficult. It was not a problem initially. And so Bunche is there at the beginning, and he introduces a lot of the key things that we associate with peacekeepers. So the first blue helmets, the idea of having no national markers, no national flags. These are all things that he argues and debates and implements. So he is really the kind of architect of that first peacekeeping mission. And he's very proud of it throughout his life.
I'm Jack Goldsmith, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 16th, 2022. Ralph Bunche, one of the most prominent Black Americans of the 20th century, was a legendary diplomat who from his perch at the United Nations was a central player in the decolonization movement after World War II. To discuss Bunche and his accomplishments, I spoke with Cal Rostiala, the Promise Institute Distinguished Professor of Comparative and International Law at UCLA, about his new book, The Absolutely Indispensable Man, Ralph Bunche, the United Nations, and the fight to end empire. We discuss the role played by Bunche and the United Nations in the decolonization movement, what made Bunche such a great diplomat, Bunche's view of the relationship between empire and domestic racial segregation, and more. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 16th, 2022. Ralph Bunche, the United Nations, and the fight to end empire. Cal, who is Ralph Bunche and why did you write a book about him?
I first got to know who Ralph Bunche was because I have an office at UCLA in Bunche Hall. Bunche attended UCLA, and he was most famous for being the first Black person to win a Nobel Prize. And he won a Nobel Peace Prize in 1950. And he had an incredible career, starting as a professor at Howard, moving on to the OSS, to the State Department, and eventually the UN, where he spent most of his career as Undersecretary General. And so he has a really extraordinary life that I honestly didn't know enough about. And the book was a chance to kind of dive into that and to tell a story, a larger story about his contributions.
So I didn't know nearly enough about him as well. And I learned a ton from the book. So Bunche spent most of his professional life, as you said, in the United Nations, but he had an interesting career before he got there, and how he got there is kind of interesting. Can you tell us, basically, you touched on some of the points, but the high points before he got to the UN?
Yeah. So let me first say the book is really a kind of professional biography. I probably address his early life in maybe 10 pages or something. So I don't get into his childhood in any deep way, but he ends up, he's born in Detroit. He moves to LA. He goes to UCLA, as I mentioned, right at the start of the existence of UCLA. And he goes off to Harvard for a PhD in government. And at that point, he's really one of the only Black students at Harvard, also true at UCLA. And he's a really fantastic student. He wins this Toppin Prize from the Harvard Government Department. From there, he's recruited to Howard even before he's done with his PhD. And he becomes a professor of political science at Howard. And that's really the start of his interest in one of the main themes of the book, which I'm sure we'll get into, which is decolonization and the broader question of who rules who and how we can end it. And while he's at Howard, he is recruited into what becomes the OSS. It's actually a kind of office that started even before the US enters the war and even before the creation of the OSS, which is the precursor to the CIA. And he's recruited in as an Africa expert because he had done his PhD on colonial governance in Africa. And there were really very few people who knew anything about Africa in the United States. So he's recommended. He joins the Roosevelt administration a few months before Pearl Harbor. And then from there, he ends up staying for several years in the Roosevelt administration, moving into the State Department, helping to actually negotiate the UN Charter, and then eventually goes to the UN after the war is over.
And he basically spent the rest of his professional life there.
Yes.
You know, basically the book is about one huge central theme in the book is Bunch's role at the UN managing and responding to the decolonization movement after World War II, as you just suggested. And that's the central to kind of tied together theme of the book.
Yes.
As you point out in the book, neither Bunch nor the United Nations anticipated the speed or scale of decolonization after World War II. As late as the 30s, Bunch seemed to assume that African independence was a long way off, and he seemed to think that decolonization generally was a long way off. And then you tell the funny and revealing story about how the architects of the United Nations building in 1947 proposed that the building accommodate 70 nations. This is in 1947. There were 59 nations at the time. So even the architects and the people in the organization didn't really plan on it, it seems, and Bunch didn't seem to fully appreciate what was about to happen. Can you tell us about that context?
Yeah, that is a really interesting part of, obviously, the 20th century generally, this book and his life. I'll just back up and say, if you get into the pre-war era, which I think a lot of us, whether as international lawyers or political scientists or others, working in politics, don't really think about enough. That era was really dominated by colonialism. And so, you know, it was the British, the French, obviously, are the two biggest, but there are many other examples of colonial empires. And so when Ralph Bunch is both a professor and then even joining the war effort, the dominant sort of feature of geopolitics is empire. And in fact, you can see World War II in a sense as a kind of battle between those who, you know, who had empires and those who had lost them. And he is very concerned about that from the beginning. It's as we talked about, his PhD topic is on colonial governance, kind of comparative colonial governance, but he doesn't see it coming. And you're absolutely right to say, you know, it's a widely held view that the process of decolonization, while perhaps desirable, some people didn't think it was desirable, but perhaps desirable in the minds of people at the time, was certainly a long way off. And that was his view. And of course, there were those who thought that it wasn't even desirable. So it's a pretty dramatic turnaround by the time we get to the 50s and 60s. And a lot of what made his career so interesting, and I think makes his story so interesting, is exactly how that happened. And I don't purport to explain in this book something as big as decolonization, but I do try to make the case that both the United Nations and Ralph Bunch were really at the center of that process in a lot of ways and played a very important role in what unspooled quite quickly. And I think if we look back, is really one of the great revolutions in political history.
So tell us more about their involvement. I mean, the UN Charter, if you read it, it's a great power document. In many respects, it talks about the trustee system, but it's not obviously a document built or designed for decolonization. How did the United Nations play that role? What were the main moving parts?
Yeah, I completely agree that the Charter, first of all, it was very much a U.S. creation, though obviously other great powers had a pretty big hand in it. But the notion was a consortium of great powers in the Security Council. That was the centerpiece of it and the real focus. And the issues around colonialism were at the periphery, though those were Ralph Bunch's interests. Those were the things he focused on. They were definitely not central to, when Stalin and Roosevelt and Churchill are meeting in Yalta, they're not really focused on that part. But it is part of the Charter, and it's part of the Charter because It had been part of the League, you know, in many ways.
You mean the League of Nations?
Sorry, the League of Nations, yeah. It had been part of the League of Nations, which, you know, is often viewed as this kind of failure or something, you know, something that isn't a really salutary example of anything. But the League ends up informing the UN Charter quite a bit. And one of the ways that it does that is in this issue around colonies that are taken from defeated powers. So the League creates a system known as the Mandate System, which Bunch studied. And the Mandate System was essentially Ottoman and German territories that had been colonies and then were sort of handed to the British or the French to rule for a while with the goal of independence, though that didn't necessarily happen or happen very quickly. And the trusteeship, you mentioned provisions in the UN Charter, which was a very central focus of Ralph Bunche's work at the State Department, was in many ways an updating of that system. And so the same basic idea, how do we take these territories and as well as others? So the trusteeship system allowed for other territories to be kind of added to this ledger and then guided towards independence, again, with a pretty long timeline in mind, but eventually guided towards independence. So that was in the charter, and self-determination generally is in the charter. And so there's, you know, there's a general sense that colonialism is something that's a way station in kind of world history. But again, it's all about the timing and how quickly it's going to happen and exactly how it's going to happen.
But so how did it happen? I mean, what did Bunch and the UN do? It's a surprising story because it wasn't really anticipated. I mean, I'm thinking about peacekeeping, I'm thinking about mediation, I'm thinking about the UN's role in pushing along decolonization.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, initially it doesn't, there's a struggle. The United States is pushing Britain and to some degree France as well to really roll back their empire for many reasons. And just, I think listeners probably are somewhat familiar with some of this, but, you know, of course, the United States has, and we have an empire even today in some ways. We had an imperial moment in the early 20th century that was pretty profound. But we, as a nation, have tended to take the view that imperialism is something we don't engage in and we don't really like. And that was a position that Roosevelt took vis-a-vis Churchill, for example. So there were kind of deep political pressures to push back against colonialism. And the UN pretty quickly becomes a site for that to take place. So both using the trusteeship provisions that I talked about, but that was a pretty small group of territories. It really ends up taking root in the General Assembly almost from the beginning. And one of the things that I map out in the book is that there were ideas on the table because of the work that Ralph Bunche did in crafting the trusteeship provisions that get picked up in the General Assembly by countries like India, for example, which gains its independence in 1947, and interestingly was even a signatory of the UN Charter, even though at that point it was still part of the British Empire. And they start pushing in the General Assembly for more scrutiny, more reporting and review of what colonial powers are doing. And it's not like the League. The League was pretty toothless on this point. It's much more meaningful. And the imperial powers are not happy about it. But there's both the United States and the Soviet Union, for differing reasons and in differing ways, taking a pretty strongly anti-colonial stance. And then the GA as a place, the General Assembly as a place where these either newly decolonized states like India or states that just had an interest in this issue could use that as a way to kind of push rhetorically the idea that independence was something that had to happen soon. And that has a ratchet effect. And as more states gain their independence, the General Assembly becomes even more significant. So it's a sort of interesting story about how this wasn't intended. I don't think anyone pictured the General Assembly being the center of this, but it ends up being the center of this movement. And as you pointed out earlier, it happens so fast that no one really sees it coming. And within basically, you know, 15 years, 20 at the most, after the end of the war, the process of unraveling European empire that took hundreds of years to put together is pretty much over.
Okay, tell us about Bunch's role in this.
So Bunch from the beginning is always interested in colonialism, and he's interested in it for a couple of reasons. One, he's a political scientist. He's looking for a topic as a PhD student, and it's a good one. Two, he's a Black man in America who is very focused and very interested in racial justice questions, and he sees colonialism as a form of racial oppression, as a form of white world supremacy. And he sees it as twinned to, and this is an important theme of the book, it's twinned to the experiences he has in Jim Crow Washington, where he's living in the 1930s and 1940s. And so it's something that's both personal and professional for him. And so when he enters government service, and especially when he gets into the State Department, he's really eager to see put into place some way to make this process of decolonization that he hopes will take place happen faster. So his first step is just charter provisions about trusteeship and the like. Then once he joins the UN shortly after the war ends, he joins the trusteeship division, and that's his first job. And he's focused directly on trying to assist these territories and people. So for example, one of the provisions that the charter has and that the trusteeship process has is that different peoples, particularly in Africa and Asia, where most of the colonies are, can actually come and speak at the UN and petition for things. And he's very active in all of that. So he's sort of pushing that all along. But I think in a sort of deeper sense, something that you mentioned a moment ago is really significant, which is he gets involved, and I know we'll get into this in some detail, he gets involved in two things that are really critical to making decolonization work. One is conflict mediation, because decolonization turns out to be fairly conflictual in a lot of cases. And likewise, the second is the development, the birth of UN peacekeeping, which he has a very big hand in. And both mediation and peacekeeping transcend the context of decolonization, but they're very, very helpful to enabling decolonization to occur in a relatively peaceful way. And he's absolutely central to both of those.
And both of those, I do want to go into both of those. Both of those elements of the UN process, I guess you'd call it, or his use of the UN process, they're not really contemplated by the charter. It's just an institution that, you know, it happens to be the salient institution that is the go-to institution for both mediation, conflict resolution, and peacekeeping after the war.
Yeah, that's right. So for peacekeeping, this is a really important point and kind of an interesting one that the charter doesn't mention peacekeeping. So peace is mentioned 50 times in the charter, but peacekeeping doesn't appear. And so, and arguably wasn't really contemplated, though there are some roots to peacekeeping. It's not like it's never happened until the UN era. There are some kind of precursors in the League era and even before, depending on how you define it. But it's definitely not a major, it's not a major thing that takes place. And so when the charter is being drafted, this is not envisioned as something that's going to be a really central part of the UN story. And of course, with hindsight, looking at it today, we know the peacekeeping budget currently is often larger than the entire rest of the budget. So peacekeeping is absolutely central to what the UN does today, and especially, let's say, in the 90s at its height. So none of that is really foreseen. Mediation, you could argue, appears in the charter in different ways with regard to the Security Council and its efforts at kind of constraining conflict and promoting peace. But it's not central. It's really thought of as something the Security Council would do or would push. And it ends up being something that actually the Secretariat of the UN does quite a bit. And Ralph Bunche himself is sort of the absolute chief mediator. So you're right. Both of these things are sort of fringe elements in what was really meant to be a document to set up a great power consortium to police the world, you know, the four policemen, as Roosevelt talked about. So these were all at the periphery, but they end up being quite central.
So tell us about what I guess is his most famous diplomatic or mediation conflict resolution success, for which he won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, so this was an issue that grew directly out of the League mandate system we talked about a few minutes ago, and it involved the territory of Palestine, then known as kind of the mandatory British mandatory Palestine. And it had been an Ottoman territory after the end of World War I. It's handed to the British. The British are trying to deal with the problem that we still face today of how two peoples can live in the same territory. And they basically, at some point after the war, sort of throw up their hands and say, we're going to hand this problem to the UN. They can't solve it. And just as an aside, it's quite interesting to go back to the 1930s, and in some ways sort of sad, and see so many of the same debates and positions being taken, and, you know, with no real change in a lot of things, even today, almost a century later. But in any event, they hand it off to the new UN. And pretty quickly, Ralph Bunche becomes one of the central figures in dealing with the disposition of Palestine. He doesn't know anything about the Middle East. He was an Africa specialist. And he's, you know, he's brought into the U.S. government because he's an Africanist. He doesn't really know the Middle East, but he does know about colonialism. And so, and he's a professor. And so he's, or former professor. So he's sent there to the Middle East at first to try to understand the, what's the problem? How do we think about a solution? And then he takes on various roles, and we can get into more detail if you like. But the one that really matters for your question is once Israel declares independence in 1948, and there's extensive conflict, war in the region, the Security Council wants to put a UN mediator in place. And the UN mediator initially is a Swedish aristocrat named Count Folke Bernadotte. And Ralph Bunche is appointed kind of his deputy. And they together try to craft a solution to the problem of Arabs and Israelis and their conflict over the same land. And there's a lot of pushback. And eventually, Bernadotte is actually assassinated. And it's kind of an amazing story because Ralph Bunche was meant to be in the car on that particular day. And instead, he misses a plane, and he's very unhappy to be late. But it turns out to be absolutely critical to his life, his future. And Bernadotte's kind of car caravan driving through Jerusalem is ambushed by a dissident kind of underground Jewish militia disguised as Israeli soldiers. And they gun him down and think they are gunning down Ralph Bunche. But of course, Bunche is not there. And so once that happens, first of all, it shocks the international community. It's a huge issue. But Ralph Bunche steps in as regular mediator. He takes over. And he's very successful as a mediator. And he ends up negotiating four different armistice agreements with Israel and Jordan, Egypt, Lebanon, and Syria. And those agreements and that process is what nets him the Nobel Peace Prize. And they're viewed as a really big breakthrough. And in a sense, they were. I mean, obviously, with hindsight, we know that he did bring peace to the region in any really lasting way. But he made a pretty major contribution, and it was recognized as such at the time.
And you go into some detail about the negotiations and what made him a great diplomat and a great in this role. Can you give us some of that?
Sure. So first of all, he was a very down-to-earth kind of guy. He had grown up in what we might now call South Central Los Angeles, very modest family background. And so in that way, he was a real contrast to the Count, who of course was, you know, this kind of Swedish aristocrat and nephew of the king and all of that. And I think his down-to-earth demeanor and style endeared him to a lot of people, particularly the Israelis. They were very, very fond of Bunche, and they liked him as a negotiator. But he was able to use his sort of charm and gregariousness as a tool in negotiating. So the context for this was he and the Count, they had thought this up together, had decided to take the negotiations to the island of Rhodes, which was a, you know, kind of a short flight away from Palestine, just far enough that everyone was sort of out of the maelstrom of the politics of the region, but close enough that they could get back and forth. And a little bit like the Dayton Accords in the 90s, you know, the idea was let's hole everyone up in this hotel and sort of force them to negotiate in a kind of hermetically sealed environment. And so that was the environment he worked in. And he would use both sort of formal elements, but also social elements. So he was a great pool player. He had played a lot of pool in LA as a high school student and college student. So he would have these late night pool games, and he was kind of a night owl. And, you know, once they'd hit midnight, they'd have a couple of drinks or whatever. And he'd say, okay, now we're going to let's talk. And he'd sort of force discussion. But he would also do these very formal things around a square table with a gavel. And so he used a number of different techniques to kind of break down the antipathy and to get each side to see the other with some sympathy and some understanding. And he was pretty effective at that. So in the end, he's able to negotiate these armistices that people really didn't think were possible. And so that makes him a kind of diplomatic hero. And honestly, even before he gets the Nobel Peace Prize, this is all over, you know, major newspapers, and he's a pretty big deal just for having done this. His techniques then end up being used in many future conflicts, Yemen, Cyprus, et cetera.
But he did win the Nobel Peace Prize, and he went from being kind of an obscure diplomat, obscure UN official, to being globally famous. And how did that change his life?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, before the Nobel Peace Prize, I would say he had, you know, he's professionally successful, but he was not, definitely not known to the public outside of maybe the black press would publish a few profiles in the run-up to his getting the Peace Prize. Because it was so unusual for, first of all, when he gets into the State Department and he actually rises to a certain level, he's the only first black person to ever hold a kind of desk position at the State Department and be in charge of a kind of wing. And so it's pretty rare. So he's attracted some attention from black newspapers, but that's really it. He does not break through to kind of mainstream white America until the Nobel Peace Prize. And when he gets that prize, it's amazing. So I think it's a combination of the fact that what he did was significant, the Cold War, you know, we can get into why he was viewed as such an incredible figure, but he's sort of instantly catapulted to celebrity. So he gets a ticker tape parade down Broadway. I opened the book this way, in the 1951 Oscars, when they get to the Best Picture Award, he's actually brought on stage by Fred Astaire to hand out the Best Picture Award, which, you know, today is just so fanciful to think that a UN official would be up there, you know, with like Ricky Gervais introducing him or something. It's just crazy. But that was the level of fame he had. So he gives speeches all over. He gets job offers all over. Truman tries to bring him back to Washington, as basically every president during the Cold War did try to bring him back into the U.S. government. So it's really, really transformative. And he basically never stops being a celebrity, even into the 60s, as he becomes kind of a, you know, more of an eminence. He's still incredibly well-known and well-respected.
But he also never stopped being a UN diplomat, UN official. And so he basically, you know, said no to all those other professional requests, and he stayed in the UN. So, and he you cite a 1969 interview where he said that the Nobel Peace Prize is what attracted all the attention and gave him fame. But he said the thing that gave him most satisfaction, and I think the thing that he was most proud of, was not that role, but his role in peacekeeping, which is another element of what the UN was doing during this period. So can you talk about that? What were the highlights of his achievements in peacekeeping, and why is, you know, we think of peacekeeping today as, how successful is it? Does it work? Is the UN doing a good job? But you make the case that it was really kind of a revolutionary role for the United Nations.
Yeah, absolutely. So next year in 2023, the 75th anniversary of peacekeeping will be celebrated. And the usual marker for that is actually this Palestine episode and a kind of observer corps that's put into place while he's there. So he's part of the very first steps. But those peacekeepers, they're still there. It's called the UN Trust Supervision Organization. They were observers, and so they were not really meant to be keeping the peace, but sort of watching the peace, I guess, or supervising it in a way, but it was an early step, but not really a full step. The full step really comes, there's a few other sort of small steps, but the marker that I use in the book and that I think is the most significant comes later during the Suez Crisis in 1956 and onward, where he helps create something called the UN Emergency Force, which is quite large, well-armed, and really a peacekeeping force that we would recognize today fully. And that's an amazing story. So the Suez Crisis, I confess, you know, I was aware of it. I didn't really appreciate what it was. And I'll just say as an aside, it's a turning point in the history of decolonization in the post-war, because it's one of these things where Nasser in Egypt sees the prime minister, leader of Egypt, seizes the Suez Canal, essentially. And there's a complicated story about whether he can do that and various treaties and so forth, which is all pretty interesting for international lawyers. But at the end of the day, he takes it and he essentially nationalizes it. And the British, the French, and the Israelis conspire to invade, to kind of take back control. And so it's this very old-fashioned pre-war imperial kind of reaction to what Egypt does. And what's striking about it, of course, is that it's anachronistic by 1956 when they do it. And so it's kind of a terrible miscalculation, strategic miscalculation on their parts, mostly because the United States is absolutely not going to back them. And we can get into the U.S. views during the Cold War more, but this was a big part of the U.S. pivoting to recognizing that while their allies, their traditional allies like the British, were very important, they had to court these new states or soon-to-be states that they anticipated that were joining the international community from the colonial world, and that supporting the British and French in Suez was absolutely the wrong move. So that's part of what helps the Suez crisis unfold in the way it does. But of course, it's deadlocked in the Security Council. The General Assembly ends up using one of its first emergency sessions to authorize this emergency force. And Ralph Bunche is the guy who puts it together. So he becomes the key kind of organizer and implementer. So he gathers the troops, he meets with the different countries. It's amazing because he gets so many offers. So he later says, I couldn't use half of the troops that were offered to me for this peacekeeping mission, which if you know anything about peacekeeping today, you know that the Secretary General has to kind of go around hat in hand trying to get troops, and it's often very difficult. It was not a problem initially. And so Bunche is there at the beginning, and he introduces a lot of the key things that we associate with peacekeepers. So the first blue helmets, the idea of having no national markers, no national flags. These are all things that he argues and debates and implements. So he is really the kind of architect of that first peacekeeping mission. And he's very proud of it throughout his life.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service
that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. DeleteMe sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate DeleteMe, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
And that wasn't the only one he was involved in. I think you argue that peacekeeping has gotten a kind of bum rap over the course of since the UN was founded, and it's actually a more important and consequential institution than we appreciate.
Yeah, I do think, I mean, peacekeeping has many problems, so I don't want to overlook those. Obviously malfeasance on the part of peacekeepers themselves, kind of strategic issues about how they're used or misused by the Security Council. So there are many ways to critique peacekeeping, but you know, if you look at, there's some really good work in political science on this that look at the effect of peacekeeping on conflict and dampening conflict or preventing the resurgence of conflict. And the evidence is pretty powerful that peacekeeping has a strong positive effect, and the UN tends to intervene in some of the hardest cases. And while there are many failures, on balance, it's been quite successful as a, you know, as an institution. And so I do think peacekeeping is quite significant. And it becomes, as we talked about, something the UN does quite a bit. So, you know, there's these few preliminary examples before Suez. Suez is the big test that UN Emergency Force lasts for about 10 years, and then it's renewed later after the 73 war. But then there are many others, Congo, which he's part of. And so by the time Ralph Bunche dies in 1971, I think there's been roughly 10 peacekeeping missions at that point. After the end of the Cold War, there's an explosion, and the UN ends up creating something like 4 missions on average every year during the 1990s. So there's a really big move to double down on peacekeeping. But again, it's a pretty successful institution, and one that I think he was rightly proud to have been a part of.
So you talk, this is taken directly from your book, in 1956, shortly before Ghana's independence from Britain kicked off a huge wave of African liberation, Bunche noted what he termed the UN dilemma, internationalism versus the encouragement of new nationalisms. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So he was worried about the way that nationalism and the politics of nationalism in new nations could undermine what he saw as absolutely central, which is the multilateral process of UN cooperation. So first of all, he was, as you might guess from someone who spent 25 years at the UN, a true believer in the United Nations, and someone who really thought that the international community had to work collaboratively through the UN to be effective. So as these new nations are sort of coming online and joining the UN almost immediately, it's one of the very first things they want to do. It's a powerful symbol of their sovereignty that they've just acquired. He does have a lot of concerns about the sort of ways in which they might integrate into the international community. And, you know, this was also a challenge because many of these states, and this is true for the Congo episode, that's a huge part of his career, had unstable and untested political coalitions. Sort of by definition, they were brand new. And any kind of indigenous capacity to govern and to sort out their politics had often been repressed, sometimes quite brutally, by European powers. And on top of it, particularly in Africa, many of these states had borders that were entirely artificial by any kind of usual metric of either religious or linguistic or ethnic ties. And so these were very complicated political processes that were unfolding. And Bunch was often there, literally there, to kind of welcome new states in. That was an important role that he played as they gained their independence. But then he, you know, he worried about how they might sort of unfold after that. And I think Congo is the best example where Congo, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, very quickly goes off the rails.
You should talk about it now. Just tell us how, tell us about this story in the context of Congo.
Yeah, this is a really amazing story that I found just so fascinating to kind of dig into. So first of all, 1960, when Congo becomes independent, is a year that Ralph Bunch dubs the Year of Africa. And that's a name that still, a phrase that still gets used today. 17 states gain their independence in a single year. So this is like the high point of this wave of decolonization that comes, you know, quite fast. And it's really joyous in many ways and often peaceful, but not always. And so Congo is an example where it doesn't go well. And Congo is, first of all, enormous. And as everything I said a moment ago about the difficulties of a new state are true for Congo, probably more than almost any other place. So it's absolutely huge. The Belgians rule in a brutal manner. There's only 17 college graduates in the entire territory when they gain independence. So there's no effort whatsoever to get Congo ready for independence. And in fact, even 2 or 3 years before the independence of Congo, very few people, even within Congo, expected it to happen. And all of a sudden it happens. So it's going fast and there's a lot of concern. And so Dag Hammarskjöld, who's the Secretary General at the time, sends Ralph Bunch, again, as he often did, to be the guy on the ground at the independence ceremonies. But he tells Bunch, you know, this one might be difficult. Why don't you spend a couple of weeks, plan on a couple of weeks? It ends up being 3 months for Ralph Bunch, and the Congo episode actually lasts for years. And within days of the independence ceremony, which doesn't go that well to begin with, in the sense that it's, you know, it's a bit, there's a lot of drama. Within days, there's a sort of revolt, and the army is rebelling. The Belgians are not really taking their hands off the wheel the way that they're supposed to. I think they somehow thought they could still control Congo. And the whole place starts to break apart, including having a civil war. And that leads to the next major peacekeeping episode, which is Bunch, again, is absolutely at the center of, but which is much larger than even what happened in Suez, thousands and thousands of troops, but most significantly, much more violent. So the UN peacekeepers eventually end up even using air power. So they're really fighting, they're taken prisoner. It's a full-on war in which the UN is a participant. So that is a really amazing turn in peacekeeping that happens quite quickly.
So that's the Congo is an example of maybe a tension or a paradox of Bunch's role. He was an American citizen. He was patriotic. You make clear that he was patriotic throughout his life.
Yes.
He was very close to American presidents and American governmental elites. But he worked for the United Nations, and he was clearly a UN person. He loved the United Nations. You know, the United Nations was a fighting ground between the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. How did he manage that? How did he manage to keep his credibility, I mean, in the United Nations, being a patriotic American, especially when, you know, during the Cold War, and Vietnam is the great example, but, you know, what the United States was doing was hugely contested within the UN context.
Yeah, absolutely. So he was definitely, you're absolutely right. He was a patriotic American. He was someone who really believed generally in the rightness of what the US does, though that was really tested for him in Vietnam. But the Cold War is critical to so much of what takes place. And from the point of view of the Soviets were pretty intransigent in the UN from sort of day one. They were, I think it's fair to say, pretty difficult. They cast the first veto. They repeatedly cast vetoes in the beginning, overwhelmingly. And they viewed Bunch essentially as having never left the State Department. As far as they were concerned, he was still working for the US. And that was not true, but I think it is true that he often viewed things in the way that the U.S. government did, and he was very close. You know, as we kind of alluded to this earlier in the conversation, he was always, you know, being recruited back into the U.S. government and kind of resisting. And he maintained ties. He was kind of an interlocutor between Washington and New York, and so he knew everyone at the highest levels, and I think imbibed some of the thinking, even if he didn't always agree. So there was a case to be made that he was, you know, sort of pushing a U.S. position, though, frankly, the Soviets thought that of Dag Hammarskjöld as well. And they thought that of the first Secretary General, Trygve Lie. They generally viewed the UN as a kind of U.S. entity, and that's not entirely unfair. It was in a lot of ways skewed towards the U.S. initially. But Bunch tried hard to be a kind of good civil servant and not, you know, not take sides. But I think inevitably he did end up lighting a bit more, maybe more than a bit more, on the American side. And Congo was a great example because the Cold War at this point, this is 1960, it's really a high point. And every single new state that is gaining their independence is viewed as a potential, you know, ally or client of one or the other of the rivals in the Cold War. And so the US and the Soviet Union are constantly trying to figure out, one, how to keep the other out, but then at the same time, how to kind of wheel this new country into their orbit. And so Congo is totally kind of a pawn in this larger struggle. And Bunch is right at the center of it.
But what was his view towards Vietnam?
Vietnam is an interesting and sad story for him. So by the time we get into the 60s, when Vietnam really starts to unfold, let's say by the mid-60s, Bunch is pretty senior in the UN. Dag Hammarskjöld ends up dying during the Congo operation in a crazy plane crash that still to this day is a bit mysterious. And a new Secretary General comes in, U Thant of Burma, who is pretty strongly outspoken about Vietnam, in part because he himself came from a formerly colonized state, and he really saw the Vietnam War as a colonial war, not as a kind of fight of democracy against communism or something like that. And so he's really outspoken. Bunch ends up being absolutely critical to the many efforts by the White House and by the American establishment to use the UN in some way to kind of manage Vietnam or maybe solve Vietnam. It's hard to say what they're really trying to do. But for Bunch, he was really distraught about the war because he pretty quickly saw that it was an unstrategic war. He didn't think it really made a lot of sense. He didn't really think it was a moral war because he was sympathetic to the colonial roots of it. And then it actually becomes a personal issue for him because his son, Ralph Jr., is drafted and actually is deployed to Vietnam. So it's one of the conflicts that is by far the most troubling for him because, and he's by this point in his life, he's seen many, many serious conflicts. And Congo was a, you know, huge part of his life for years. But Vietnam is really personal for him because he's always been someone who thought the US was generally on the side of right, and he doesn't think it at all here. But at the same time, he's absolutely central to this effort to kind of broker something between the UN and the US on how to deal with Vietnam. And I alluded before to how U Thant was outspoken. That drove people like Johnson crazy. And so, and Dean Rusk and others. And so they're always kind of on Bunch trying to say, like, how do you get him to shut up? Like, this is a real issue for us. But at the same time, trying to somehow figure out a way to usefully deploy the UN. So he becomes very entangled in it and quite disillusioned by it.
Because the UN ultimately didn't have any success.
No. It was too hot and too big of an issue to be mediated. So there was various proposals put out. The Pope and other people suggest mediation. But, you know, this is way too big. And Bunch can't really do anything. So I think partly it's frustrating for him. You know, at this point, by the mid-60s, he is the kind of world's greatest mediator. And he's mediated in Cyprus, you know, he's mediated in Palestine, he's done all kinds of Congo, etc. So he's viewed as someone who has a magic touch, but he can't touch this one. It's just too much. And, you know, as I mentioned, it is a personal thing for him. And of course, you know, the larger political climate, the ferment in the United States, he's living in the US, he's seeing this, and he's really troubled by it. So no, the UN doesn't end up doing much, though there's a lot of effort. So LBJ throws a state dinner for U Thant, and of course Bunch is there. There are many, many times when he's in the White House talking with or in Foggy Bottom at the State Department. The Fulbright Committee actually does an entire set of hearings up at the UN. They all fly up there. So there's various branches of the US government trying to figure out how can the UN be useful, but none of it really takes hold.
But is this the limits of the United Nations? Isn't the reason that Bunch and the United Nations, I'll use the word failed here, you can correct me if you don't agree with that, just because it involved the United States directly? And isn't that, you know, the limit of the United Nations? Doesn't it come when in addressing conflicts by powerful nations as opposed to less powerful ones, where it can insert itself with the implicit backing of one or several of the big powers? Is this one of the limitations of his diplomacy?
Absolutely. I guess I would only differ slightly, or maybe it's an interpretive question about whether it's a failure for the reasons you just gave. So the charter is designed to protect the interests of the permanent five members, the US, the UK, et cetera, Soviets at that time. And so that is deliberate. That is what Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt want to create in at the end of the war. And so we see this today, of course, with Ukraine. So, you know, many people right now beat up the UN over the fact that nothing can be really done about Ukraine through the UN, but that is by design. And so absolutely what you're saying is correct. Vietnam sort of by design could not really be touched. You know, Suez was an example where two P5 nations are involved, but it could be touched only because the United States made it so. You know, Eisenhower made an affirmative decision to say, we are not backing this. And people were creative about using the General Assembly, and there was a way forward. But when you're dealing with one of the two superpowers, there's no way forward. So that was a frustration, but it was, again, by design. So I think maybe not a failure, but a limitation, absolutely. And so Ralph Bunche understood that. He didn't like the veto in the Security Council. He thought that was bad in many ways, but it was a reality, and he knew it wasn't going to change. So this was a source of frustration, but, you know, he understood the real limits. Within those limits, he tried to do what he could, as did Entente, but none of it, you know, for many reasons, I mean, Vietnam is such a complicated issue, but for many reasons, I really think none of it had any impact.
Yeah. Okay, I want to switch to the relationship between international and domestic affairs. Bunche was eloquent throughout his life and interested in the relationship between empire, global empire, and domestic racial segregation. Can you tell us about that arc?
Yeah. So in his early career that we talked about, his scholarly focus is primarily on empire. But of course, as a Black man in America in the 1930s, he's deeply personally affected and interested in segregation, racial oppression. And he's at Howard University, which is a place that really brings together the very best people in the country thinking about these issues. So he's steeped in that milieu from the beginning. He's very active in the NAACP. He helps create the National Negro Congress, a number of other organizations that he's active in. So this is a big part of his life from the beginning, from his professional beginnings. And he did see colonialism as a piece with it, as a manifestation of white supremacy, as a project of global racial justice, as we talked about a little bit before. And so to him, they were simply two sides of a coin that needed to be understood as part of the same process. And he would often urge people to really think globally about the larger problems that this country faced and to see them in a kind of larger frame. He was not unique in that. There were others, W.E.B. Du Bois and many other leading thinkers who saw it that way. But he was the one who had the maybe was most pragmatic and also was in a position to actually make a difference because of his unique role, both at the State Department and then especially at the UN. So those were two sides of a coin. You know, then in addition, during the Cold War, he's not alone in this, but he's one of the first people to really strongly point out the fact that as the Cold War is really unfolding, that the US is sort of disabled and hamstrung in its efforts at attracting these new states coming out of Africa and Asia by its own racism. And that the fact that that Jim Crow was alive and well in many places, that segregation was still a fact of life for many people, really made it hard for the US to claim, hey, we're the champion of Ghana or something like that. So we can get into that more, but that is something that he talks about quite a bit, especially once he wins the Nobel Peace Prize. He's giving speeches all over the country constantly. He's being asked to do commencements and whatever. And he often talks about this issue that the US can't have two kinds of democracy, two brands, one for export and one for import. They have to be aligned.
So say more about that, because it's really interesting. And how was that view, which he articulated early on? He wasn't the only one, as you say, obviously, but how did it become absorbed into the US, you know, foreign policy establishment in the U.S. government? I mean, how did that work?
Well, you know, I want to be clear, many other people have written extensively about this and talked about historians and others about this kind of issue of civil rights in the Cold War. But it's a really important and interesting story. And, you know, Bunch's role in that is, again, he's one of the early adopters of the idea that that the U.S., I mean, I think he saw it in two ways. So he saw the Cold War as a tool to force the U.S. to push a little bit on the intransigent elements in American society to say, hey, it's not just a moral issue. Of course, it always was a moral issue for him, but it's not just that. That racial justice actually is going to help us win this Cold War. So that was one side of it. But then, of course, you know, he also saw it as something where, you know, if we recognize the importance of racial justice, we could do, you know, we could go out and make friends with these different countries and ally with them. So so he was kind of at the pivot point between the external and the internal dimensions of this. But it took a lot of forms. So, you know, I think some people are probably aware that in the Brown v. Board litigation, the State Department weighs in. And, you know, so there's an effort to say, hey, this is really causing us problems internationally. And we need to think about changing the way we do things at home if we have any hope of winning. And Bunch was absolutely on board with that throughout. And really, you know, of course, he was very excited about the result in Brown. But he also, in some ways, saw it as vindication for views that he had long held.
So you're both a scholar of international law. You have a law degree and a scholar of international relations. You have a PhD in political science. And your academic work is about both and their intersection. For me as a reader, I mean, I learned so much from this book about Bunch that I didn't know about. But it's also, you know, you use Bunch as a foil almost, or maybe to tell the story of international law and international relations kind of in the middle half of the 20th century. Anyway, it's a great story about, and a compelling story about the history of international law, especially the United Nations and international relations in the, as I say, the middle half of the 20th century. What, you know, you spent, it seems, years on this book. It's an extraordinarily learned book. What did you learn about your disciplines from writing the book?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I appreciate everything you said. I did try to, you know, I think I mentioned this in the kind of the foreword of the book that initially I thought about a sort of biography, but really something that was more a story about decolonization in the UN. And it became more of a biography as I wrote it. And it is a biography today, but you're absolutely right. I do try to weave in some of these broader themes about how we think about geopolitics. I guess for me, I learned a number of things that really stood out. So one, you know, I think this is maybe less true for international lawyers, certainly about the scholarship of international law than for political science. But, you know, we tend to kind of forget about empires and to think about, you know, the kind of classic IR conception of states and their interests and sovereignty at the center. And that's all, I think, you know, pretty important and accurate and so forth. But it's not really fully accurate. And in fact, when you get into the pre-war era, it's really not accurate at all. And arguably not accurate for much of the 20th century. So there's a lot there about empire and the importance of empire, and also the importance of race that has been a little bit expunged from IR thinking. And even in international law, there's not enough of it. So I think an appreciation for the way that politics, world politics, was racial politics for, let's say, the 20s, the 30s, certainly, but even into the 40s, that was a really central feature and one that people thought about overtly. By the time you get to the post-war era, there's a kind of effort. I mean, Nazism obviously deeply discredits racialized thinking, though it doesn't end it by any means. And so there's an effort to kind of move away. And then the Cold War very quickly kind of creates this billiard ball model that you see reflected in kind of classic IR theory, but it's still there. So that was really, really interesting for me to kind of understand. And then decolonization itself, which is an element of that. I knew something about it, of course. I thought it was important, of course, but I didn't appreciate, one, how interesting it was, and two, how significant. What a significant revolution it really was. How quickly it unfolded, and how dramatically it ended. And so in some ways, to me, this is not answered by the book, but the normative change, the way that empire goes from something that's accepted and even valorized to something that's, you know, ended and viewed as a kind of sad chapter is really extraordinary. And, you know, maybe it reflects the way we think about war, you know, so in the, you know, and certainly in the 19th century, you know, war was something that was often valorized even into the 20th century. We don't really think about that today in the same way, but this is even more dramatic. So I do find that really interesting. I learned a lot. I can't say I addressed it fully in this book, but I tried to at least tell that story, surface it, and show how central this particular person and the United Nations was to it.
So, Cal, the title of the book is The Absolutely Indispensable Man. And you're referring to Bunch, obviously. Why was he indispensable in summing up his career?
Well, I took the title from something that Dean Rusk, as Secretary of State, says during, this is during the Vietnam War period, says to Lyndon Johnson in introducing Bunch to Johnson, though Bunch had actually met Johnson several times at this point, but Rusk sort of forgets that. They're at the White House and he kind of brings Utant, the Secretary General, and Bunch upstairs to meet with Johnson privately. And he says, this is Ralph Bunch, one of the two absolutely indispensable men at the UN. And then he quickly adds that Utant's the other one. But it's clear that Rusk, as well as Johnson and many others, saw Bunch as the real mover and shaker, the person who was indispensable. And in fact, later in this same evening, Rusk tells Bunch, Utant's up for kind of renewal. And he says, you know, it doesn't really matter whether he stays on or not. You have to stay there. You have to stay at the UN. You're our guy. The UN needs you. The international community needs you. This was something many, many people said to him, especially at the end of his career when he really wants to retire. And he can't, essentially, because he's being either, you know, encouraged or sometimes practically ordered to stay. So he was absolutely indispensable in the eyes of the American government and, you know, arguably in the eyes of much of the international community. Many, many ambassadors, as rumors of his impending retirement sort of circulate within the building, come up and beg him to stay on. And he does. He's kind of a good soldier and he stays on really, honestly, longer than he should have because his health was bad and he was suffering, but he felt he had to.
So my last question is about why Ralph Bunch is, as you put it in your book, largely forgotten today. I mean, he was world famous for decades. He was hugely plugged in to both the international community and the American government, hugely consequential and important and famous black man. But today he is kind of he's faded in some sense. Why is that so?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. And, you know, I've been asked this question a few times. I've mulled it myself, even at UCLA, where, you know, I have an office in Ralph Bunch Hall and we have a Ralph Bunch Center. A lot of students do not really know who he is. They know something about him, but they really don't know. And certainly most Americans don't. It is amazing. I think part of it is that his mid-century fame was a product of a kind of unique constellation of things. So, you know, one, the UN itself was brand new and very popular. So even amongst Americans, extraordinarily popular, you know, in the run-up to the negotiations over the UN, it's something like 80% of Americans polled, you know, think it's really essential that we join this organization. And, you know, the later years, it remains quite popular, though that popularity starts to fade, of course, by, you know, even the 60s and into the 70s. But for much of Bunch's career, the UN's extraordinarily popular. The Cold War is absolutely central to American life and American politics. And he's viewed as this kind of key figure, you know, with a kind of magic diplomatic touch that's really important. And he's a kind of unique figure in that while there were people like Jackie Robinson, a fellow UCLA alum who he was friendly with, considered a friend, knew quite well, who had broken through the color line in different endeavors, there were very few Black Americans in professional settings who are widely known. It was just incredibly uncommon in that period. And it's a sort of sad statement about our society, but that's the reality. And so he was this unique kind of figure. So when you put those things together, the Cold War, the importance of the UN, his kind of unique form of fame, the Peace Prize, you know, was now, I think the Peace Prize is obviously still incredibly important, but it doesn't have quite the same cachet in some ways that it did then. So he was really catapulted into a unique place. And I think for a lot of Americans as well, he was viewed as someone who, and this was something he resisted at times, he was viewed as a marker of progress. They could point to Ralph Bunche and say, you know, look at this person who, despite being a Black man, has achieved at such a high level, and sort of take that as a sign that we really weren't so bad as a country. And so, you know, he, of course, bristled at those kinds of characterizations, but that was pretty common as well. So I think there's a number of kind of contextual reasons that made him so famous in the mid-century. To be fair, it's been 50 years since he passed away. That's in 1971. So more than 50 years at this point. So it has been a long time. But I am still amazed that someone as consequential as he was, as interesting as he was, as famous as he was, isn't better known. But of course, that's kind of partly why I wrote this book. And so my hope is that this book will bring him back into the public consciousness, at least for some of us, and give us an appreciation of what he did as a person, which is really remarkable.
It is remarkable. Your book is remarkable. It's excellent. And I hope it does bring Bunche back to the place he should have. Cal, thank you very much.
My pleasure. I really appreciate being on.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6. And check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer for this episode was Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.